Okay.
No, she doesn't.
Okay, so once again. Okay, so once again, welcome back, everyone. So as I was just mentioning, despite the somber mood in the world after everything happening in Paris and elsewhere, at the same time, we have one of the more optimistic holidays coming up in a few weeks, but because we meet only once a month, I thought this would be this is our opportunity to look a little bit at Tu B'Shvat. And we've been looking at different holidays. So we'll look at Tu B'Shvat, and then we'll look at Purim, and then we'll look at Passover, if you're not all too busy before Passover to make it. But what I'd like to do is to examine. We know that on Tu B'Shvat, we have the practice very often. Many of us will sponsor planting a tree in Israel or something along those lines. And so we know that it's considered the new year for the trees. And so I thought that it would be a great opportunity to examine a little bit, what does a tree represent in Jewish thought? What does a tree stand for? What does a tree represent? It's not a topic that we necessarily think about, but if we consider a tree, its rootedness, the sort of the shape of a tree, and sort of the leaves that emerge from it, we can begin to see almost in terms of the physical shape and then the lifespan of a tree, although many trees, you know, do quite well, and God willing, by us, we should all have such lifespans. But if you think about it, physically and otherwise, the tree really, I think, yields a certain kind of symbolism. And in fact, in some of our prayers that we're familiar with, we talk about a tree. Anyone familiar offhand with a song or something in our liturgy where we talk about the tree as a symbol?
The tree of life.
Okay, tree of life. Good. Okay, when we return the Torah. Right? There you go.
That's what the Torah scroll is attached to.
That's exactly right. Right there, you got the Atzei Chaim, is the actual wooden poles, and those are representative, certainly, of exactly this, of this tree of life, and we're going to look at that, and that's something that's a famous song, of course. We sing sometimes when we return the Torah to the Ark, it's Chaim Hi, but it is a tree of life. So certainly this is something that's part of our symbolism. We're going to see as well that the very beginning of Psalms, the beginning of Tehillim, the very first chapter, 150 chapters in Psalms, the very first one compares a human to a tree. So it's right there. It's something that we find right at the beginning. King David puts it out there. Yeah.
Is that before Adam and Eve on the tree?
All right. Adam and Eve in the tree is very interesting. That our first sort of taste of sin and encounter with the commands is associated with a tree.
Tree of knowledge.
Tree of knowledge. Right. There's a lot here. And we can already sense that there's a certain richness and depth to this comparison. So what I'd like to do... That's right. And why would that be? What does that symbolize? Why would that be? What does that symbolize?
Well, it could symbolize people coming together forever, not separate. Mm-hmm. A tree lives for a very long time, generally.
Uh-huh. Right. So there's a certain, if not eternity, a certain longevity that's associated with the tree. Very good.
We talk about tree of life, but, you know, when the families have these trees up for their generations.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
it becomes symbolic.
And you find that. Family.
That's right.
Family tree.
Yeah, family tree. That's exactly it, because there's also a sense of rootedness, a sense that that's where we come from, that's what anchors our identity. I think that a tree, in terms of the depth of its roots and sort of the importance of being rooted in a family tradition, in a religious tradition, these are very sort of resonant and salient ideas in Judaism. So I think that these are things that really reflect this idea of the symbolism of the tree. So what I do is I gave a lot of sources. I'm not going to read through everything. I gave both the Hebrew and the English. We'll read mostly in the English. I have the Hebrew here for reference as well. And what I'd like to do is just to examine a wide range of different points of comparison. Really two comparisons that we'll examine. One is between trees and humans, and the other one people, and the other one is between trees and the Torah, which we've already seen that the Torah is a tree of life. And we're going to see how this sort of perhaps begins to emerge and how we can take and understand what the symbolism really represents. Okay. So, the first place actually is a very surprising context, not necessarily what we would have expected.
Right.
And this emerges in the laws of warfare. In the book of Deuteronomy, toward the very end of the Torah, the 20th chapter of the final of the five books of Moses, right? So toward the end, it talks about the laws of laying siege. Laying siege, nothing to do with our topic, it would seem, at first glance, and yet it becomes very relevant. So let's read the verses together. When thou shalt besiege a city a long time, right, in making war, right, against it to take it, so thou shalt not destroy the trees by wielding an axe against them. Okay? Good. Right? Thou may eat, right, for thou mayest eat of them, or you're allowed to eat from the trees, but thou shalt not cut them down. Now, let's just pause there for a second. So what we're saying is, we're laying siege to a city. So the Jewish army is invading, let's say, the land of Canaan, right? The land of Canaan at the time, the biblical time. They're entering what subsequently became known as the land of Israel. So they're laying siege to a particular city during a time of warfare. So what are they going to do? They're going to cut down trees. Why would they want to cut down trees?
There could be places to hide.
Okay. I heard weapons.
They could be places to hide.
Okay, good.
Ram.
Good. Ram. What? Okay, right. Ram, right? We're gonna knock down the doors to the city, right? We're going to ram our way in. Okay. So what does the Torah say? Now, the Hebrew here is ambiguous. And here's the one place I really think it's important to read the Hebrew, because the English translation here already is a little bit biased. Okay, it's already sort of what we call leading. It kind of leads in a particular direction. So the Hebrew reads, Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, for a person is a tree of the field, lavo mi panecha b'matzor. To what? To come mi panecha, before you. Mm-hmm. Right? B'matzor means in a siege. So what does that mean? Okay, what does that mean? Right, for a person, but this is what the comparison is, right? Because a person is a tree of the field. A person is a tree. What does that have to do with not cutting down the trees to be used as weapons during a time of siege, during a time of war? What's that talking about?
I think a lot of it dealt with also the fruit of the trees that destroy the food and the people
are
dependent on.
Okay, good. So maybe ki ha'adam yitzah, so that means excellent, means what? Ki ha, that a person is a tree of the field, meaning what? Since humanity relies upon the fruit of the tree for its food, for its sustenance, therefore we're not allowed to cut it down, because this is considered to be an act of warfare that is unethical. In other words, if you want to attack the enemy directly, that's one thing. But if you want to go ahead and do what? Okay? If you want to go ahead and starve them, that already is considered to be questionable, which is a very interesting, if we're doing the ethics of warfare, this is an interesting discussion as an aside, but that's one interpretation. Now, if you look at
the question is it different if you cut down a fruit tree as opposed to another tree?
That's right. That would be part of the discussion. According to this view, the answer would be yes. You would imagine that this would not apply to a barren tree. What we call in Hebrew an ilan srak, a non-fruit-bearing tree, would presumably be okay according to that.
Is there a civilization in the world beside the trees that have things like this?
That's right.
What you can and cannot do, what is ethical and illegal.
Act
in a
of war.
Of all things.
That's right, and they blame us. They claim the exact opposite about us.
It's what? A very practical thing not to do that, since in many cases, when you siege into a city, you take it over.
Yeah.
And then
you'll end up hurting yourself. Uh-huh. You're saying itself. It's what we call enlightened self-interest. That's right. In other words, sometimes there's sort of obvious self-interest, but this is already a more sophisticated sort. That could be as well. Now, if you take a look at the English translation, there's an alternative view that's put forward. And the truth is, this reflects two views among the commentaries. Take a look in the English. It says, right after the semicolon, I'm about five lines from the top. It says four. Four right before the end of that verse. Mm-hmm. For is the tree of the field's man, that it should be besieged of thee? Question mark.
Yeah,
What does that mean? For the tree of the field, man, that it should be besieged by thee? How do we understand this verse? Good. So is this a statement that is declaratory? In other words, is the verse meant to actually, according to this reading, does it actually compare a human to a tree? What's this way of reading? The other way around. So what kind of statement is it? Is it a statement at all?
We don't have to fight nature. We just fight our enemies. We don't have to destroy anything.
Right. So according to this, it's not a statement. It's rather it's a rhetorical question. Do you see, this is a very different way of reading the verse. These are two different ways of reading the verse.
Remember, it's Jewish, it's Yiddish, everything is a question.
Everything is a question, everything is a joke, right? Just a little bit of a, right? Of a cutting kind of thing. So, right? So it's a challenge, right? Even a little chutzpah there, right? As it were. So what's it saying? According to this reading, what the verse is actually saying is humanity like a tree? Is a tree really compared to a human being? Ki ha'adam itza sadeh, is a person comparable to a tree? No. Against whom are you going to war?
Right.
Right? Are you warring against trees? Is that what it's come to? Right? Against people, obviously. So now, on this reading, and by the way, we're not going to read it, but in sources 2 and 3, Rashi and Ibn Ezra, who are the two of the classic medieval commentaries, they split on this question. The translation that you have here follows Rashi, one of the greats. Rashi translates this as a rhetorical question. So on Rashi's reading, is there or is there not a comparison between humans and trees? Would you say? If it's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, if there isn't a comparison.
There, it's correct. There's specifically not a comparison. And then, this is an interesting verse for the laws of war, but according to Rashi, it's not our topic, because it's not actually drawing a comparison. But the alternative reading that we began with, and that in fact, Abraham Ibn Ezra, one of the outstanding Spanish medieval commentaries, living really in all of Jewish history, Ibn Ezra's commentary is that no. It's not a rhetorical question, it's a statement. It's a sort of an equation. And what it's saying is that we are compared to trees in the sense that we are, as was said, dependent upon trees, and therefore it's an unethical act of warfare to cut down the tree in order to ramrod open the doors of the city, because after all, that is outside the bounds of what is legitimate in a time of war. So this is already in the Bible itself, in the five books of Moses, in the Chumash, already we find this, at least according to this reading, one reading of the verses, in a surprising context, like left field, the laws of warfare, we find this, the beginnings of this comparison. Yeah.
Well, as humans, we should be fruitful and multiple.
Okay. Very good. Well, that could be more like fish or something than like trees.
Well,
fruitful.
Fruit grows on the trees.
I see.
And the trees are the one that are fruitful. You don't destroy.
Okay. We're going. That's very good. We're going to see.
It's just a translation.
No, but she's not wrong.
She's not wrong.
You're right that might. Fruitful itself might just be a turn of phrase.
Right.
But what we will find, though, is we will find this comparison, exactly what you're saying. We're going to find that in the Talmud itself. So we're going to get there. This is very good. Okay, so that's one source we begin to see in the five books of Moses in Chumash already. And then, as I mentioned, we have another example in the book of Psalms. Right at the very outset, King David introduces this comparison. Take a look, literally reading from the beginning of Tehillim. Source number 4 at the bottom of this page. It says, happy is the man, right? We say, Ashrei ha'ish, how fortunate is the person that hath not walked in the counsel of the wicked, nor stood in the way of sinners, nor sat in the seat of the scornful. In other words, King David admonishes us, we should be careful in terms of who our friends are, right? With whom we sort of come together. If we come together with wonderful groups of friends and people who are coming to study together and to grow together, so that's a wonderful thing. Sometimes we have to be wary about with whom we associate. So then he continues, but his delight is the law of the Lord. Rather, the person whose fortune is someone who enjoys the Torah, enjoys engaging with the Torah, in his law doth he meditate day and night, someone who's truly immersed in the Torah, and such a person, writes King David, and he shall be like a tree planted by streams of water. Right? Like a tree planted by streams of water that bringeth forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf does not wither. Right? In whatever he and in whatsoever he doeth, he shall prosper. Not so the wicked, they're like chaff, the wind simply blows them away, and so on. So what's King David's comparison here? What's the significance? The righteous person immerses oneself in the Torah all day long. And then what? And that person is comparable to?
A tree by a stream.
So it absorbs the water for its nourishment, just as people absorb the water for its emotional and mental and everything else nourishment.
Right, that's right, very good.
Just as a tree, mm-hmm. which is immersed in the ground and the roots, mm-hmm. so are people. Mm-hmm. You know, what you get forth comes forth from the learning and doing the same as a tree.
Good, very good. What about excuse me, what about the leaves? What does he say about the leaves of the tree?
They don't fade. Mm-hmm. They don't dry out.
Okay, right.
They don't wither.
In contradistinction to whom?
Well, man eventually
keep reading.
Does. The older one gets.
Okay, good. But keep on reading.
You start to deteriorate. And
okay, good. But we'll keep on reading in verse 4 in the English.
No, as soon as in the congregation of the righteous.
Mm-hmm. But that's already 5. But what about in 4, though?
The chaff.
Mm-hmm. They're like the chaff. Which they're inconsequential. They're not needed. They're not wanted. When you throw up, you know, when people like literally do that, when they've harvested wheat, whatever, you separate the wheat from the chaff.
That's right. And what? How do you do that?
Throw it up in the air and let the wind blow the chaff.
Right. What do we call that? What process is that agriculturally? What? I just thought I heard it.
Winnowing is.
Yeah, that's winnowing. You throw up the chaff, and the wind does the work for you, essentially, right? Does the heavy lifting, right? And separates the chaff from the wheat. So there's this sense of there's the water, there's the nourishment, sort of the softer side of what it means to be a tree. That's one aspect that's associated with the righteous. But then, right, there's a certain kind of substantiveness, a certain kind of rootedness that comes with that. If I'm nourished by water, in other words, by the Torah, so then what happens is I become deeply anchored, and I'm consequential, and it's not just so easy to simply, to blow me away. So again, we have this comparison, and there's a third time, right? Example number 3, where we see that the Bible compares between human beings and trees for Tu B'Shvat, and that's in source 5 in Jeremiah. Take a look at this one. Okay, it'll sound familiar because it's quite similar to the verses from Tehillim, from Psalms that we saw. For he shall be, this is in chapter 17, verse 8 of Jeremiah, for he shall be as a tree planted by the waters and that spreadeth out its roots by the river. And this is talking about the person who is righteous, right? And who shall see when heat cometh. But its foliage shall be luxuriant and shall not be anxious in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit.
Rabbi.
What are the characteristics of this righteous person? Is there anything different from what we saw in Tehillim?
It's similar, but it's still strong. It's not mentioned before.
Very good. So what does that mean? What is the metaphor? What's the metaphor?
Is steeped in Torah. This is his way of life. Mm-hmm. We'll be able to sustain whatever vicissitudes come along in his life from the outside, whether it be a death or a loss in business or what have you, you know.
Challenges of life.
The Torah will sustain them through all of this, just the way a strong tree can withstand a drought.
Mm-hmm. Good. So sort of self-sustaining, right? Or self-sustaining.
Resistant to the environment.
Does it say about the obligation of a tree?
Yeah.
So not only to give fruit and for man to send out the knowledge that he's learned.
Ah.
I couldn't hear.
So you want to say it?
Yeah. A tree has an obligation to give fruit to others. a man's obligation is not only to become a scholar, but also to teach others of his knowledge.
Right. That's very beautiful. The idea that it brings forth fruit, and so there's that obligation.
Another way, very nice. I'll take it a little further, is that, well, when the tree spreads its roots and you get the fruit, when it comes to human beings, if the person who is the tree, the ancestor, is a good, righteous, and person, the fruit, his fruit is his lineage.
Progeny. That's right.
And the children and grandchildren that are produced from his fruit.
Yeah, that's right. Beautiful. That's we're gonna see that in the next source. That's beautiful.
I tell you a story. Where we used to live, the property across from us, which now belongs to Kahalet, but it had a very large cherry tree, which used to bear edible fruit.
Oh, yeah?
And what happened was that it was dying, or they were killing it, or whatever. But I found on my property, about 75 feet away, it spread its roots. And it survived.
75 feet away on your property.
It survived. Wow. And it started bearing fruit again.
Wow.
On my property.
On your property.
Not very many, not very much. But it was fruit. And frankly, the birds ate it. No, it was good. They ate it. That was fine. I left them.
Right. But that's right. God finds all sorts of ways. But it's a testament to, you're saying, to the sort of the deep rootedness. And I guess what you're adding is that even when it would seem that the tree has seen better days and will not survive, that there's a certain kind of tenacity almost.
On the other hand, it could have put the seeds from the tree, tree could have
passed over
and grew new fruit, which is the next generation.
Except it wasn't the seeds, it was the roots that spread.
75 feet, though.
I don't know about that.
That's far, though.
I don't know that.
Yeah.
Secondly, we had an arborist who, when I commented on it, pointed out that the trees will spread their roots when they are going under.
Interesting. Okay. All right, could be. All right. So then, what I'd like to do is to now look. So we've seen already, just to summarize, three instances in the Bible where we see a comparison between trees and people. We see it in context, perhaps, of the laws of siege, laying siege at war. We see it certainly in the beginning of Psalms, where King David opens up his book of songs, book of poetry, by telling us about the comparison between the righteous and the tree versus the evil, who are not compared to the tree and are like the chaff and just simply get blown away. And then finally in Jeremiah we find also this idea of this sort of self-sustainability of someone who's steeped in the waters of Torah and of the mitzvot. Now, not coincidentally, I think, the rabbis pick up on this comparison and they run with it in all sorts of really beautiful and moving directions. So I'd like to share some examples. One appears in Source 6, and this is a very moving story that the Talmud teaches us. The Talmud says as follows. When they were about to part, so these are two scholars who had been spending time together. They didn't live in the same community. They lived distant from one another, but they had some time to spend together, and it was a very beautiful moving experience for them. And the Talmud teaches as follows. When they were about to part, Rabbi Nachman said, "Pray, Master, bless me." So he asks his teacher to deliver him a blessing upon his departure. He replied, "Let me tell you a parable." So his teacher responded to Rabbi Nachman and said as follows, "To what may this be compared?" Right? This blessing that you're asking me to give you. Right? What would be a proper mashal, we call it? What's a mashal in Hebrew? Anyone familiar with that term? A mashal? Right? A mashal is a comparison or a metaphor. Right? So let me give you a metaphor, essentially, to summarize the request of a blessing that you have just made from me, your master. To what may this be compared? To a man who is journeying in the desert. He was hungry, weary, thirsty, and he lighted upon a tree, the fruits of which were sweet, its shade pleasant, and a stream of water flowing beneath it. Very beautiful imagery. Where does this come from, by the way? Where did the rabbis draw this imagery from, presumably?
Is that when...
An oasis, okay. But I mean, what we saw...
No, it comes to me when Job was having travail, and then... It sprung up, and they saved...
You're thinking of Jonah.
Gotten with a J.
Yes,
at
that's
any
right.
rate, and because he didn't want to go to Nineveh and deliver.
Yes, that's right. And then he
sent a worm of whatever to
a tree. Tree. Yes.
So that whole.
Good. So you have this in a range of places. You have it elsewhere as well, as was mentioned. You have a couple of different examples. I just want to say, maybe it's even from Eden, but I just want to suggest as well that maybe you got it from some of the verses that we've already examined. Remember, we saw, right, the brooks and the streams of water, the shade, right, all of this. I wonder if the rabbis are drawing it directly from the Bible here as well. I don't know, there are some of the examples that we've seen as well. Could be, I'm not sure. Anyhow, so this hungry, weary, thirsty person who lights upon the tree and the stream of water flowing beneath it. He ate of its fruits, drank of the water, and rested under its shade. When he was about to continue his journey, he said, "Tree, O tree, with what shall I bless thee? Shall I say to thee, may thy fruits be sweet? They are sweet already. That thy shade be pleasant? It is already pleasant. That a stream of water may flow beneath thee? Lo, a stream of water flows already beneath thee. Therefore, I say, may it be God's will that all the shoots taken from thee shall be like you." That'll make a beautiful passage, more beautiful passage. Forgetting the Talmud, almost anywhere. I mean, this is golden, right? This is where the rabbis moves from prose to poetry. I mean, this is really gorgeous. But what I think this brings out is, A, the rabbis were sensitive to this metaphor, and they extended it. They extended it in a gorgeous, moving kind of way. And I think that the idea that part of a tree's legacy, as was mentioned already, is the next generation, is the progeny, is the fruit that it bears, I think is part of this discussion as well. Now, does this remind anyone of something we've learned in previous meetings? Anything that sounds familiar, resonant at this point?
It sounds like the Garden of Eden, but I don't know.
Okay. Do anyone remember? I think most of us were here. We talked about someone who planted trees for future generations.
Johnny.
Oh. I remember Johnny Appleseed. Yeah, that's right. That's one of the topics of our lectures. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
He planted the tree not for himself, but for the succeeding generation.
That's right. Exactly. Very good. Yeah. We had the class about Choni, who drew the Magal. He drew the circles. Right, and he stood, and he was this impetuous, seemingly like this impetuous child who stood in the middle and said, "I am not moving from here until you send us the rain." Right, like that. And God actually acceded his request, which we discussed. Seems to be poor parenting, but that's a whole other discussion. We saw that there was a subsequent narrative about the same personality that a little bit later on he was wandering the fields and he chanced upon an individual, an elderly man who was planting a fruit tree, right? And he questioned him and said, "For whom are you planting this? You're not going to see the fruit of your labor." And the man said, "Well, it's not for me, but it's for my grandchildren." And this is part of the lesson that Choni had to learn.
But so he mentions that others had planted for him.
Yeah, that's right, correct. Just as others planted for him, so too I... That's right. Because the kinds of people who are going to plant for others are most easily, at least, those who saw those models in their homes and grew up with that. We all tend to default to what we see at our home, and then our children tend to default to what they have seen in their experiences. There's no guarantee. It doesn't dictate necessarily, but it has a real effect. That's right.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You're talking about not cutting trees down during a siege.
Yes, but, the Bible is, yeah.
Where we used to live, on the proper, we just came from New York and Muncie, and we spent the whole weekend there. And our previous property is owned by religious Jewish people who are on what was originally an apple orchard.
Really? In Muncie?
In Muncie. And
there were a lot of apple orchards in that area.
That's right. And they had a big problem because they couldn't put a pool in for their children because of the apple tree. Mm-hmm. So they had to make sure that the pool didn't disturb the apple tree. Mm-hmm.
So instead of cutting down the apple tree, what would most people do?
Some people might have done.
Some. Okay, fair enough. Great correction. So, right, and why did they do that?
Because they weren't allowed to cut down.
We just learned that it comes from this verse. Right.
Yes.
It literally comes from this verse.
And unfortunately, when we had planted our house, there were a lot of apple trees.
We were in a former apple orchard.
Oh, yeah, so we cut down a lot of apple
trees. Well, it's complicated because if you cannot otherwise construct a home, there are complicated questions, but they're really questions of Jewish law. Mm-hmm. Much like wearing my phylacteries or woolen linen or keeping Shabbat or whatever. It's a question of Jewish law.
We had
cutting down a tree, a fruit-bearing tree.
We had an acre of land in Muncie.
Okay.
And we had 36 apple trees on that land.
Mm-hmm.
And I wound up, I didn't do it myself, but I wound up having 30 of the 36 apple trees taken down.
Okay.
And of the ones that were left, I remember I spent 6 hours in an apple tree pruning it. And it gave me apples that year the size of small pineapples.
Grapefruit. They were this big. And my father brought them into his store to show. He had a pile of these apples on the counter to show everyone how big an apple could grow.
Mm-hmm.
And we collected our apples and brought them to a nearby...
We brought them to the county welfare home and gave them to them.
Very nice. That's beautiful.
Beautiful.
Very nice. Well done. Okay. Okay, so those are some of the comparisons that we find between a tree and humanity. We're going to circle back to that in a few minutes. The second comparison that we find, a parable, is between the tree and the Torah. And we've already mentioned one, and this is a verse from Proverbs. If you take a look at the top of page 3 now, okay, so you find, right, this is the classic verse. This is what we mentioned earlier. Eitz chayim hi, lamachazikim ba v'tomchei ha-miushar. She is a tree of life to them that lay hold upon her. Right, she's a tree of life, and happy is everyone that holdeth her fast. And this is, of course, in reference to
the Torah.
And this is the source for which, as was mentioned earlier as well, we call the handles of the Torah, the wooden handles, are called atzei chayim. Right, these are wooden trees of life, and that's where the art comes from in many of the synagogues. Right, and all of that all comes from this imagery of this verse in Proverbs. So we have the tree is a mashal, is a metaphor for a human. We have the tree now also as a metaphor for the Torah. Now, the question then becomes, what does that mean? right? Because I understand a human being is organic, is growing. There's a developmental aspect to what it means to be a person. We're never exactly the same as we were just a moment ago. Right, we're constantly growing. We're striking down roots. We're gaining nourishment. Right, we are bearing fruit and sharing that with others around us. So the comparison between a tree and a human, both of which are growing and constantly in states of subtle but meaningful change and growth, development. So that I understand, what does it mean that the Torah is compared to the tree? How do we understand that comparison?
The more you grow,
okay, but then you're saying that really the comparison is to the person, not to the Torah itself.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So it's really for the person. Okay, good.
Tree represents tradition. It doesn't change.
Okay, so maybe there's sort of the counterpoint, which is that trees are interesting because they have both of these components, right? Trees, on the one hand, are forward-looking in the sense that they're bearing fruit for future generations and that they're constantly evolving, and yet there's a rootedness, and so there's that sense of rootedness in tradition. And what we want to do throughout the course of our lives and as a Jewish people is to strike a healthy balance. Roots, but also organic growth and moving ahead, right? And continuing to grow for the future, yeah.
The Torah is the fruit of knowledge.
Back to the Garden of Eden again. Yeah.
No, you read the Torah, it's like you're devouring sustenance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as opposed to the tree in Eden, which was illicit, this is not only illicit, but it's right, it's life-giving. It's exactly the ideal, 100%. Now, what I want to share with you is a passage. We're not going to read the whole thing, but a passage from the Talmud about the Torah. And what it describes is, in addition to the sense of rootedness, it describes the Torah itself as luxuriant, as somehow growing together with us, which I think is a really interesting kind of imagery. And I'd like to share it with you just a little bit. Let me find... let me find the relevant. We'll start from the beginning. Actually, one second. Let's start. If you jump down in the English about 13, 14 lines, the first word on the line is the word text. Everyone sees that?
What's the first?
First word on the line is text.
Yeah.
Text. About 13 or 14 lines down. Okay, the text teaches planted. This is the Talmud. See how this is the Talmud's exegesis, or really excursus, on a verse from the book toward the very end of the book of Kohelet. The book of Kohelet compares the words of the wise to staffs and nails and all sorts of interesting comparisons. And the Talmud tries to understand. Have it. Over here. Talmud tries to understand what's the basis for this comparison, how do we understand it. This is a particularly important passage because the Talmud is commenting on a verse from Kohelet, so it must be important. That was a little bit of a joke for those of us who find ourselves in Kohelet. So the passage, this is a classic passage, an interesting one, challenging one. And it continues, and it says as follows: just as planting is a thing which is fruitful and multiplies, so too the words of the Torah are fruitful and multiply. The masters of assembly, these are disciples of the wise who sit in manifold assemblies and occupy themselves with the Torah, some pronouncing unclean and others pronouncing clean, some prohibiting and others permitting, some disqualifying and others declaring fit. Should a man say, how in these circumstances shall I learn Torah? Therefore, the text says, all of them are given from one shepherd, one God gave them, one leader uttered them from the mouth of the Lord of all creation, blessed be He, and so on and so forth. And this says, it cites actually from the Ten Commandments, and God spoke all these words. Okay, so the passage in the Talmud here compares the Torah to something that is fruitful and multiplies. right? To read back, just as planting is a thing which is fruitful and multiplies, so too the words of the Torah are fruitful and multiply. What does that mean, that the words of the Torah are fruitful and multiply? How do you understand that?
It might refer to the different interpretations that develop over generations.
Good, yeah, 100%. It certainly does. Yeah. Okay, so what's the, right? So in other words, the question is really, do we see the Torah as something that is completely disconnected from humanity, and that all we do is this sort of, it's this inaccessible thing that we try to understand? Or does God perhaps actually create Torah in such a way that we are intended to be partners in the unfolding of what it is that the Torah means, and that God tells us, well, what I actually want from human beings is to take their intellect, to bring it to bear on the Torah, and to do our very best to try to understand what it is that the Torah is coming to tell us? Do we have divine revelation in that process?
Questioning.
Do we have, right? And so that's what we have. We have people sitting around, right? We're sitting around tables and studying and trying to understand. And God says that's not an accident. That's not a mistake. That's not a plan gone awry. Right? Rather, that's exactly what I wanted to happen. And when the scholars come together and they try to understand, and through all the studying that takes place, the understanding of the Torah that emerges from that organic process means that the Torah, in a sense, has been deepened, it has become fruitful, and it has multiplied. And it becomes a richer kind of almost living organism by which or through which we continue to grow together with our tradition. So I think that there's a very beautiful sense in which the Torah is luxuriant, and it is almost, it also is an organism in that way. And just as we grow, so too the Torah grows together with us. Which I think is a really moving kind of imagery. Okay, last piece that I'd like to share with you. We're going to skip a little bit, leave aside a little bit, and I want to refer you, one second, sort of a final theme that I'd like to mention. We're not going to read the whole source. If you take a look at 11, okay, number 11, okay, and this is also from the Bible. God bless.
Thank you.
And if you take a look at Ezekiel, okay? Ezekiel, one of the books of the Bible, the prophet Yechezkel, Ezekiel. And this is a section, actually, it's read after the Torah reading in the Haftorah, the sort of the passage from the prophets that's read after we read the Torah proper on Shabbat. This is read in the Parsha of Vayigash. So this is read, we read this just a few weeks ago, because now we're at the beginning of Exodus. This is a section that's read together with Vayigash, which is toward the end of Genesis. And it's a vision for the Messianic era. And what it describes is that there are two tree branches. So here it's not a full tree, but here it's a branch of a tree. And this is a prophecy that God comes to Ezekiel, and he gives him an image as to what the Messianic era will be like. Now, just a word of introduction that I'm sure you can help me with to this understanding this passage. What was the situation in the first monarchy of the Jewish people? How many kingdoms were there?
It was King Saul.
There was one.
There was originally one.
Then
how many there? And
two,
then
the north and the south.
And then there were two. So if you remember the basic history, we had the kingdom of Judah was the original legitimate kingdom. King David was the king, and then his son Solomon. And then after Solomon, at the time of Solomon's son, David's grandson, known as Rehoboam, so at that time, the kingdom was torn asunder, was split. There was a rebellious king up north named Yeroboam, the son of Nevat. He begins a second kingdom in the northern area of Israel, the southern kingdom known as Judah, the northern kingdom known as Israel or Yisrael. Southern kingdom is the two tribes, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, and the northern kingdom is known as, right, if there are 12 tribes overall, right, so then that's where the notion of the 10 tribes, right, the 10 tribes, the mythical lost 10 tribes that, you cross, rivers, ancient mythical rivers to try to find the lost 10 tribes and all of this, right? Okay, right, Midrash, in India, etc. Who knows? Some thought that the Ethiopian Jews were qualified as these interests, right?
There's another black
Yes, I know you're...
That they claim to be from Israel.
And we don't really know anymore, and this is to some extent been lost to us, but this idea
but
that...
They found the Cohen gene in them.
Yeah, they did. They did the... it's not the Falashmura, that's the Ethiopians. I saw the story recently, I don't remember the details.
I don't remember
that's
the name, but it's not the Ethiopians.
No. Some more recent. It's fascinating. Anyhow, we don't know for sure. But we've been searching for for millennia, right? For quite some time. And so what the verses here describe is that this ancient split, this tearing asunder of the Jewish kingdom will ultimately be symbolized, or the Messianic era will result in, or will be captured by, the reunification of these two kingdoms. Because these weren't just competing kingdoms, or two different kingdoms that had differences of opinion. It was much worse than that. Unfortunately, we know that they were warring, and there was a certain amount of civil war that took place, and they really took up arms against one another, and this is a very dark chapter in Jewish history, in biblical history. And so the Messianic era will see the undoing of that cataclysmic split and their reunification of these kingdoms. So take a look at this symbolism. And the word of the Lord came unto me, God bless, came unto me saying, and thou son of man, okay, God constantly refers to Ezekiel as son of man, which is a really interesting kind of piece, but leave that aside. Take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and the children of children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel, his companions. So one of them is for Judah, and the other one is for Joseph. Joseph is representative of the northern kingdoms of Israel. That's right. So you have Judah, the southern kingdom, Joseph, the northern kingdom. The king that I mentioned earlier, Yoravam ben Nevat, was descended from the tribe of Ephraim. And join them for thee, one to another, into one stick, and they may become one in thy hand. And when the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, wilt thou not tell us what thou meanest by these? Say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, the 10 northern tribes, and I will put them unto him together with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in my hand.
I gather the word stick is used in a...
And it uses the term eights. It uses intentionally, I think, the same term that's used as a reference to a tree. Now you can see the remainder of this, and it talks about the monarchy of King David, and you can see the very moving description and how they'll no longer be divided into two kingdoms, they'll be unified into one kingdom, and you see it in the continuation, but it's very much along these same lines. And so what I think that the Bible... Where?
It's a stick in the translation.
It should be tree, really.
Yeah,
I think tree, I think, is a better translation. I don't think it means a whole tree. They're trying to make it a little bit more...
Like a branch?
Yeah, like a branch of a tree. I think that's what it means. But in other words, the verses are stressing that it's the branches ultimately come from that tree. And I think what we're finding here is that there's an interesting kind of phenomenon here, which is that naturally... If I were to ask you, right, trees are generally separate from one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes?
Generally,
generally, yes.
Yes.
Well, yes, they grow separately, but it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Sometimes from the same
the roots okay. intermingle.
They tend to intermingle roots. When you're growing trees, what do you very often do?
You'll
not just prune, and then you'll graft one onto the other, right, in order for them. That's a very common kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You'll then pull it back into the ground, and then it'll join together with another tree. And in fact, there's a lot of discussion in Jewish law about this idea that sometimes actually, if you have a group of different saplings, source 12, we're not going to read it inside, but it actually is relevant to the laws of the sabbatical year, that if you have a group of young trees, of saplings, that normally we don't do a certain amount of work on the land during the sabbatical year, but if they're young enough and they're sort of vulnerable enough, that at least at certain points you're allowed to do a certain amount of limited work with these trees, because they're interdependent and they're really one unified field, and they need a certain kind of assistance for them to grow together as a field. And so what I think is really happening here is that what we're saying is that when we compare humans to trees, until now we've really been thinking about discrete individual trees, right? We've been saying that a person, each individual person, is comparable to a tree, right? And we've seen also the righteous person, right? That's what we saw in Psalms, and all of these things, right? And each member of the city is dependent, eats individually, eats is dependent upon the trees of the field, and therefore we're not permitted to lay siege, all of those things. What I think the later prophets are doing now is they're taking this comparison, this metaphor, to a new level. And they're saying trees are also interdependent, and miraculously at times, although in nature to a lesser degree, trees actually sometimes grow together. And what I think it's suggesting is that part of the vision for the Messianic era is that just as trees sometimes grow not only discreetly, but come together, and even in unexpected, even miraculous ways, that exactly is going to be our destiny as well. And I was thinking about this. Go ahead, yeah.
Is there any position on the grafting trees? Because that can have a different connotation.
That's right. Now that can sometimes be also problematic. That's an intermingling, right? That's different kinds of trees.
Just like you can't use two materials together.
That's right. And that can cut the other way. And I think that has to do with the idea of sort of respecting God's natural boundary, that there are natural boundaries in the world among humans and among his creation, and that we kind of want to respect that and not tamper with that.
So is there an official position on grafting?
Sure, there is. I mean, there is a prohibition against grafting in certain in cases, according to Jewish law. What the parameters are, details, etc., that requires a whole class. But there is such a concept. There is such a notion. Okay, why was I thinking about this particularly in this context? So I don't know if you saw this this announcement. It was right around. It was just a few weeks ago, or less than a few weeks ago, beginning of the year, about the Jerusalem Unity Prize. Did you see this? The mothers of these three three teenage boys who were brutally murdered at the beginning of the summer, and everything that happened in Israel. These mothers have been rocks, at least publicly. They have been really very strong in terms of not only pulling through, but seeking to take the opportunity to perhaps help the Jewish people heal certain wounds. And we know that that unfortunately, with all of Israeli politics and all these things, it can be challenging for there to be a sense of unity. There are different visions for how we navigate some very challenging decisions that need to be made in the state of Israel. There are, you know, Israelis, pretty much what they love to do more than anything else, their top passion is talking politics. I don't have to tell you, I'm on a listserv with teachers. It's a new teacher who's teaching Israeli students, and he asked the listserv, he said, can anyone help me try to figure out how to get my Israeli students to stop talking about politics all day long? They can't learn anything, because that's all they want to do is talk politics. So he put this out to a group of seasoned educators. Someone help me, I don't know what to do. So we know that building a sense of unity in a very challenging environment, in Israel in particular, can really be challenging. But of course we know that it's the things that are most challenging that are sometimes the most significant, the most important. And there's this just a very moving story. I'll read it quickly. And this is just the press report. The Jerusalem Unity Prize, the last source, has been established in memory of three Israeli teens who were kidnapped and murdered by Palestinian terrorists. This prize, in memory of Gilad Shar, Ayal Yifrach, and Naftali Frankel, dual American and Israeli citizen, was announced Thursday by Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat. The prize was developed in partnership with the families of the three boys and Jerusalem-based organization Gesher as a way to perpetuate perpetuate the spirit of unity which existed across Israel and around the world during the days following the boys' kidnapping. The boys' mothers, who became a symbol of the unity during the nearly two-week ordeal from the kidnapping until the boys' bodies were discovered, created a video announcing the prize in which they call on Jews to take a deep breath and bridge the gaps that divide us. The award will be presented in three separate categories: individuals or organizations, social initiatives, and Israel in the diaspora, each with prizes up to about $25,000, and so on and so forth. While grappling with the unknown question of the fate of their sons, the Yifrach, Sharon, and Frankel families taught the entire world a remarkable lesson in courage and showed us that unity is a value that enables us to overcome even the greatest challenges, Barkat said. The Jerusalem Unity Prize will spread this message from Jerusalem across the world, become the eternal legacy of these three remarkable young men, and so on. So this is, I think, a very moving kind of initiative that I think, to me, it really is resonant at this time. It also fits beautifully with our theme. Because really what we're suggesting is that this sign, this is not so easy, but ultimately this is the sign of the Messianic era. And this is exactly, this is really something to strive for. So my blessing to all of us is that really we should certainly merit all of the comparisons to the tree, that the Torah should nourish us, that it should give us a sense of rootedness and yet luxuriant growth, that it should pass on not only to ourselves, certainly, but to our progeny, as was mentioned, that should be the blessing, just like that was the blessing of the tree, and that beautiful passage in the Talmud here as well, and hopefully in terms of trees coming together, and that unity it represents as well. Yeah.
It states here that this Unity Day is going to be June 3rd,
yes,
2015 in Jerusalem.
Yes.
Isn't there something that we can do here in the United States, mm-hmm, to also, yeah, commemorate?
Oh, that's very beautiful. You notice they're planning to give prizes for the diaspora as well. So they will be awarding the prizes to the diaspora, but I think that's very important to think about. I think there's no question, 100%. So I thank everyone as well, as always. I wish everyone a wonderful Tu B'Shvat in a few short weeks, and we'll see everyone soon.